This is the Eco Innovators Podcast, your go-to source for the Canadian energy and natural resource nexus. I'm your host, Stuart Muir. In this series, we're talking to the people turning today's challenges into tomorrow's solutions. Welcome back to another episode of the Eco Innovators. This is the podcast where we talk to the world's leading minds, driving us toward a greener, more sustainable tomorrow. Our guest today is a force to be reckoned with in the world of clean energy. So I'm going to introduce you to that guest, Jed McLean. He's the trailblazing executive director of the BC Centre for Innovation and Clean Energy. Jed is not just an engineer, he's an innovator, tirelessly focused on creating and implementing solutions to combat climate change. From academia to product innovation, his diverse experience paints a picture of a man dedicated to our planet. Jed, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Stuart. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. I'm going to point out to our listeners that our disembodied voices are coming to them from my garage. And you walked over. We live in this great walkable neighborhood we both do in Victoria, British Columbia. You began your career as a professor of mechanical engineering.
Actually, I'm going to correct you there. Mm-hmm. I began my career as an instrumentation engineer in the oil and gas industry. And after a couple of years of doing that, I went back to graduate school and then began the career in artificial intelligence research. And it wasn't until 1994 that another trailblazer, a guy named Jeffrey Ballard, walked into my office and suggested that maybe I should put my time into something called a hydrogen fuel cell. And so Jeff Ballard very much influenced and made my career, along with a fellow named David Scott. So my background is broader than energy.
Yes, yeah. Those are some well-known names on the West Coast. The Ballard name has been globally influential
Indeed. In
the things you did early on. You also founded Angstrom Power, which was another fuel cell hydrogen technology play.
Indeed, yeah, I did.
It was interesting that when you went back to academia, you went on that track rather than staying at that time in business, but then you kind of came back full circle. But you went back and you led the Pacific Institute for Climate Solutions. You worked on the Permafrost Carbon Feedback Action Group. It was really a question of leveraging your knowledge and experience to put together the technology and then the business innovation that was aimed at decarbonization. You were really one of the early movers in knitting together these different pieces that have to work together if there's to be any progress. A couple of years ago in 2021, you embarked on a new venture, and that's largely what I'd like to hear from you about today, because at the BC Centre for Innovation and Clean Energy, you are doing this holistic piece of ensuring that the funding needed to seed and propagate new ventures in the space, which is philosophically aligned to business success. You're taking down barriers to new entrants into the market to succeed with their ideas so they don't just wither and die at the roadside. And that's a very important piece of the business development ecosystem. And I've seen how the center has worked hand in hand with the corporations, academic institutions, policymakers, investment groups. Would you say you're an incubator, you're a venture fund, you're an angel? Like, are you all those things? What would you call it?
I find it curious that, and I don't mean this negatively, although it'll come across that way, everybody wants to define us as a thing that they know about, an incubator, an accelerator, a hub. I hate hubs. So let's imagine that we take the XPRIZE Foundation, we take an early stage venture capital corporation, and we take a conventional grant funding organization, and you put them together in a room, and I don't know what metaphor you'd like to use as to what the product of that interaction would be, but you end up with CICE. What we're doing at the Center for Innovation and Clean Energy is behaving like venture capitalists with the money that we've been entrusted with. We want to make investments that have a future and that'll make a difference. So climate is number one. Economic prosperity is number two in terms of our priorities for investment. But we behave like a VC. We give grants that are non-dilutive. So that's kind of like a grant funding agency. And we target what we give the grants to kind of like the XPRIZE. We find the things that we think are most impactful, that we think within British Columbia we have the levers to pull that can actually make change, and we target that. And we can talk about that in a few minutes if you want to dig deeper into that. So what is that? Is that an incubator? Is that an accelerator? Is that a hub? I really don't care about the label. I care about the output. I care about the outcomes. We've been around now for 18 months. We've entertained almost 200 company proposals, and we've funded 23 of them for about $14 million so far, from zero to that in 18 months.
And we'll get into some of those success stories in today's podcast.
Yeah.
I noticed that you don't talk about net zero. You talk about net negative carbon future, which is a term that I don't think has been out there much. Can you explain what that is?
Certainly. The idea of net zero is a great target, but it's not the ultimate end state. Even when we get to what we think is largely zero emissions, we have two problems to deal with. One of them motivated by, in a sense, by climate justice, which is something we might want to talk about a little bit in the podcast. There's an accumulation of carbon in the atmosphere that's too much. And even once we get to net zero, climate stability that's going to be equitable to people in the world won't have been achieved. So we have a climate restoration task ahead of us that may last for several hundred years. And then also there are impossible to decarbonize industries that I expect will be around. And so they will require a continued negative emission, if you like, a continued reduction or drawdown of carbon dioxide removal from the atmosphere to the tune of about 5 gigatons a year. That's going to be ongoing.
To balance out at zero,
yeah, exactly.
They have to be negative.
Yeah, so our world has to be in a net negative state to manage these things and also to draw down on the accumulated carbon debt, if you want, that I think is in the atmosphere.
In your experience, Jed, what are the most significant challenges that Canada right now is facing to achieve this end state? And adding to that, how can thought leaders, innovators, our audience here help to overcome these challenges?
I think there's one, and I think that we could talk for days about challenges, but it's that we need more primary energy that has a zero or negative carbon footprint. We have very little of it. We go to electricity in British Columbia. We think we have this wonderful, abundant, clean electricity. Well, it's not quite as clean as we think. It's very clean, but it's not quite as clean as we think. And it's finite and it's limited. Right now we have a surplus of electricity in British Columbia, but that won't last for very long. You look at all of the things that we want to do to decarbonize, and they're all electrify this, electrify that, right? Mm-hmm. Electric vehicles, home heating. So the demand on our energy system for energy inputs, electricity principally, is massive. We need lots more. There's a great study that came out from some colleagues from UBC a few years ago about the electrification of trucking. Okay, so these are all caricature studies, right? But nonetheless, so you take the heavy-duty trucking fleet in British Columbia and electrify it, right? How much electricity do you need? Short answer, 4.5 times site C, which is 1 gigawatt, right? So about 4.5 gigawatts. Let's go to hydrogen, 7.5 gigawatts because of the losses in the transformation from the energy carriers, right? So, and if you look at the 2023 federal budget, what's the big message? Double the electrical supply in the country. That's the big issue. But electrification isn't everything, right? We need other energy inputs for other processes. So that's the number one thing, the number one challenge. And I think Canada is well-positioned to become a very strong, you know, energy superpower. You want to have all the highfalutin titles, go for it. But that's the big issue, and everything derives from that.
You just skipped over about 15 rabbit holes that I would be very happy each one to
jump into.
Into for an hour or so. But we do have to keep this this work today as succinct as possible. One rabbit hole, if I may. California state recently said they are going to electrify their heavy trucks. Mm-hmm. Is it possible to do that?
Sure.
And where will they get the energy to do it?
You want me to tell you?
Yes. How?
No. Well, it's possible to electrify, but where will they get the energy to do it?
Yeah.
So it's just a great example of what I see a lot of, which are these wonderful proclamations that play really well in a soundbite. We're in a podcast. Sorry. But when you really dig into it, you say, well, wait a minute. And this is one of the big problems with hydrogen. You know, there's a lot of new entrants into hydrogen who are not really realizing that there are no hydrogen trees. There are no hydrogen mines. You know, there are no hydrogen fish that you can just scoop out of the ocean, right? It's a synthetic product from other energy inputs. Where's that coming from? And so these comments like the ones out of California, they're fantastic because what they do is they drive demand for electricity, which has to be clean. So the demand is going and going and going, and that provides an ambition to provide that. But it's not clear where that will come from in the short term.
I don't see nuclear solutions as being as high up in the public discourse in pretty much any country right now as you'd expect. If your only goal is to get to the maximum amount of green electricity, surely that should be. I wasn't planning to go down the nuclear rabbit hole. I mean, you look surprised, but I mean, that surely is one of the things here that has to be talked about more.
I would know a lot more about nuclear if I felt that we had some levers to pull that would move action on it, but we don't. And therefore, I would claim to be relatively ignorant of the technical details and nuance of nuclear. However, that said, I would be very supportive of an agenda to move nuclear power further forward faster. Mm-hmm. I'm incredibly disappointed with what I keep hearing on the nuclear front. I'm talking about nuclear fission, right? So conventional nuclear, not fusion. We can talk about that in a sec if you like. Small modular reactors. I hear about this all the time. Okay. I've been hearing about small modular reactors almost as long as I've been hearing about hydrogen fuel cells. And yet where are they? The site in Pickering, Ontario, I think is now held up as like, yeah, they're getting one going. The reason it's going to go within the next 5 years, I think, 5 or 7 years, is because it's already a nuclear permitted site. So it's purely a technical implementation. They don't have the social license issues. They don't have the permitting and regulation issues. If you put those onto it, the world hasn't changed vis-a-vis nuclear, even if you have a small modular reactor.
And it doesn't really matter what you want to build, whether it's wind, a solar farm, SMR, a pipeline. It's all going to be opposed by a really smart and effective oppositional force of one kind or another.
It seems to be the case, right? That no matter what you want to do that's going to be impactful, i.e. large scale, there is opposition from various places. And I don't quite know what to make of that. Perhaps it's a kind of a utopian ideal that people cling to that they're out there somewhere, there's a solution that has no costs, no impacts, that we just need the ambition to get to it, or we need to give up our egos or whatever vested interests that people presume we have. We know that that's not true, right? There's always losses in systems. It's like thermodynamics, right? The systems are always wasteful. There's always inefficiencies. And we have to deal with those socially as well and find the best way forward.
There's a bit of human nature in there. More than aspiring to things
more than
we
a
don't.
Bit. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind, Stuart, that technology is a human creation and technology progresses through the interaction of humans. So technology is a fundamentally, and I would argue, uniquely human endeavor. Don't ever leave the people out of the technology because we make it.
Well, that's a big discussion now with some of the new technologies that have burst onto the scene.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes.
You know, you come out of the hydrogen business, the technology of hydrogen. We've seen the efflorescence of hydrogen speak in political lingo all over the world. It's as if one need only say hydrogen and there will be this great hydrogen solution manifest itself. But the world's not that simple. We are seeing companies like Toyota that went all in for some time, at least, on hydrogen fuel cell technology because they thought that was a future. They seem to be maybe hedging their bet now a little bit, but still committed. But then everyone else is more electric or battery electric. How do you think it's going to develop from here, given your background at the origins of hydrogen technology in terms of, you know, consumer experience of what's hydrogen in their lives and what isn't?
So from the point of view of hydrogen as something that a consumer would interact with as hydrogen.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I was at UBC recently. There's a new hydrogen filling station there by Thunderbird Stadium or the hockey arena. And I think it's just opened up. So I'm not expecting there's large lineups. And besides, who's got a vehicle that needs hydrogen right now? But, you know, infrastructure dollars were spent to make that happen. And it's happening elsewhere too. There's a BC government program to build that infrastructure. So things are happening, but is it the right thing? Is it happening fast enough? What are the gaps?
Sure. You know, by the way, that there's a hydrogen refueling station down the street from us.
I don't know that. I don't have a hydrogen car, I guess. I stand to be educated.
Okay. So there's five refueling stations in the country, and one of them's within 3 kilometers of where we're talking from. Now, I don't know how many cars it's filled up, but nonetheless, there's one there. And the one at UBC is put together by a UVic graduate, one of my former graduate students, Walter Morita. Fantastic work that he's doing. You know, the student becomes better than the master and all of that stuff. No kidding. Like, you should see this guy go. He is so smart. It's just great. I'm very proud of Walter and all the stuff that he's done over there. So, okay. I think with hydrogen, one of the challenges, and I've lived this challenge, I have scars on my back that are quite deep. Hydrogen offers an amazing promise, but when you start to move into applications, what I found with Angstrom Power, and we successfully put hydrogen fuel cells into cell phones. It didn't change the size or the weight of the cell phone. We ran them 2 to 3 times longer on hydrogen than you could on batteries. This was circa 2010, we achieved that. So, you know, big value proposition, right? Back then, smartphones coming in, you could run this thing for a couple of days on hydrogen. But all of a sudden you had to pay to recharge your phone, right? Because you had to buy hydrogen. And now you had some safety issues. You had some heat issues. And what we found was that there were a lot of these sort of what I would call second order issues that really conspired to make the promise of hydrogen and the nameplate value, longer runtime, lighter weight. At the end of the day, it wasn't the only thing people cared about, but it's all they talked about when we were planning and building the product, right? And then it was like, oh yeah, well, we forgot to mention all these other things.
Yeah.
So then the other challenge that we faced was when we began our work in 2001, 2002, nickel cadmium batteries were the state of the art. They were an easy target. By the time 2010 came along, lithium ion batteries, you know, that was the first market that they really got going in, was the handheld electronics market. They were serious and formidable competition and showing 5% a year cumulative average growth in performance, cost ratios, whatever you want to measure the performance by. So what we found was that the incumbents got better and better and better. They were fighting back. Whereas when we began, we presumed that the incumbents were kind of done, right? And this was, you know, opportunity for us. So let's look at the electric vehicle. So the fuel cell vehicle, first time I was in a fuel cell vehicle was about, I'll give you a stat. Mm-hmm. Ballard is very proud of the fact that 30 years ago, like yesterday or the day before, they drove their first fuel cell bus to Science World in British Columbia and showed it to the premier 30 years ago. That they've been developing this fuel cell technology. So where are we today? Still demonstrating fuel cell buses. There's a few places in the world where they're actually putting them into revenue operation. 30 years for that development, right? So what's happened in 30 years? Batteries, electrification, synthetic fuels, HDRD, like renewable diesel, some of these fuels, right? Incumbents are coming along and they're finding ways to fight back. So here we are developing the hydrogen technology for vehicle applications, but the competition's getting way, way harder. And so the bar keeps moving. And it's really frustrating to be a hydrogen developer because, you know, you think the bar is here and then by the time you get there, it's it's moved on. So what's happening is that it seems that the beachhead application, if you think, is moving as hydrogen is a neat fuel, and there's other things to do with hydrogen. So hopefully we'll get to talk about that because I'm pretty big on hydrogen. Mm. Despite what this might sound like, into the heavy-duty trucking application. Because in heavy-duty trucking, you have two big problems. One is you need a lot of energy stored. And so the battery combines the power you get with the energy you store. With the fuel cell, you decouple those two things. So you build an equivalent of an engine, and then you can have the equivalent of a gas tank, which can be as big as you need, right? Mm-hmm. So from a design point of view, you can optimize things, I think, a little bit better. All the electric vehicle people out there are probably going, oh, no, he's all wrong, you know. So, but that's fine. I mean, this is a debate. So that's number one. But then number two is that the duty cycle is quite quick. All right. So that you can refuel quite quickly. You can refuel a hydrogen fuel cell truck. So this is interesting from the duty cycle of big trucks. There's a third factor, which is uniquely Canadian. And that is that battery capacity doesn't do well in really cold environments. And in fact, CICE has just funded a project to develop weatherized refueling infrastructure for hydrogen refueling of trucks. And the whole project is like, how do you refuel a hydrogen fuel cell powered truck at minus 30 Celsius? Mm-hmm. Nobody's done that before, curiously. But that's a great opportunity because that's a huge enabler in the performance. They're all electric vehicles, by the way, whether they're hydrogen powered or battery powered, right? They're all electric. They're all hybrid. But the fuel cell vehicle can be refueled, and the performance of the hydrogen technology doesn't drop off as a function of temperature the way batteries do. So there are advantages. There are challenges. And I read a report out of the Fraunhofer Institutes in Europe, and they were looking at this scenario, and they said, but you know, labor laws say that you can't operate a truck for more than 4 hours at a time before the driver has to take a 45-minute break. And we figure that you can recharge that truck's battery in 45 minutes. So isn't the whole sort of hydrogen shtick kind of suspect because of the labor laws around drivers? And I never thought of that one before, right? But it's these kinds of things that sort of conspire. We think of hydrogen as just a simple drop-in replacement for other motive power in vehicles. There's a lot more to it, right?
Jed, you're a member of a lot of advisory committees, consulting, you're talking to people all the time. These groups that are advocating for cleaner energy sources, for addressing climate action initiatives, where do you think they are in 2023? We've had a year behind us when the term energy security, which wasn't really in the lingo, suddenly, thanks Putin, came into much higher usage, and the bit of a shift. It was interesting to see recently that Premier British Columbia returned from a trade mission to Korea and Japan, talking about LNG, talking about hydrogen. He said difficulty talking about LNG at home, maybe because of some of the political nuances of the place where he gets votes. But coming back from seeing things in Japan, you know, I was in Japan years ago, took my son over. We went to see the Tigers play baseball, and outside their stadium, they have what look like giant baseballs, but they're actually giant storage tanks for gas that are spherical and painted to look like baseballs for fun. But I think if you did that in Canada, people would be horrified that you're so close to, you know, all of this gaseous fuel that maybe something would go wrong and you should be worried. But there, they clearly weren't worried. They were going out to the ball game. And I remember talking sometime after and relating this to a diplomat from Japan I was sitting beside, and asked him to explain this to me. He said, well, in Japan, we're obsessed with energy security. We always have been, because we don't have our own resources. And so we must depend on it. Any energy we have is precious energy, and we appreciate having it. So if, you know, those baseballs are there, that then they're happy. And we've seen them agonize in Japan on where they source energy from. They could get lots of natural gas and LNG from Russia if they wanted to. They could get lots from the Middle East if they wanted to. And well, indeed they do from both sources, but they also want more from Canada. And I think there's perhaps an awakening of that in Canada, that we can be a part of that solution. And I'm just intrigued, because as you look at all these different voices in civic society and academia who are, you know, duking it out to some extent to be the ones whose ideas win out over the others, you know, where do you think we're going to get to in terms of the pragmatic, practical outcomes of what's likely?
So it would be nice if that was a yes-no question. There's a lot to unpack there, Stuart. Mm. Let me just say a few things about the international scene, and then I'll talk about advisory committees and what I think of them. because I don't hold strong opinions, as you may be sorting out already. So there's a couple of big factors, big trends that are going on and that we're seeing a lot of. Don't forget, we talked about hydrogen, but in CICE, the institute that I created and run, we look at hydrogen, we look at low-carbon fuels, by the way, where hydrogen is a feedstock for low-carbon fuels, be they bio-based or electricity-based, the so-called e-fuels. Mm-hmm. We could talk about that. We work on battery and energy storage, and that's the context in which I can talk about the international situation a little bit, because we're just finishing a blueprint report on strategies for how we go forward with innovating in that space. And then the fourth is we work on carbon management, which is the path to net negative. So we got lots to talk about. Yeah,
yes, we do.
I wasn't able to prepare very much for this podcast because that keeps me motivated.
I didn't
busy.
Want you prepared. Yes, we went off the cuff. Okay, so spontaneous at this.
Okay,
podcast.
So let's just talk about three massive factors. Okay, so one is the Inflation Reduction Act in the United States, which has a certain amount of protectionism in it for made in America. Mm-hmm. The second is the rise in the importance of ESG, right? Environment, mm-hmm. social, governance factors in things you buy. Third is carbon intensity. And fourth is the war in Ukraine. Now, let's put all that together. And you start to look at supply chains, particularly for battery materials, where it's no longer just a simple question of a fight to the bottom and cost. Security of supply is becoming a bigger and bigger concern for countries like the US, but also for countries like Japan. That's massive. The carbon footprint, if you like, or the life cycle carbon, embodied carbon associated with materials that you buy and sub-assemblies you buy, is starting to be accounted for and starting to be counted as a cost. So that whole life cycle analysis is becoming more and more important. And then just in general, the fragility of global supply and the link to the geopolitics, like the war in Ukraine, is forcing people to look at places. And Canada is currently ranked number two in the world for battery materials. And I forget a Bloomberg study on this. Mm-hmm. Behind China. China has cost and just, complete supply. And then Canada's next. And why? And the answer is because of all this ESG stuff, because of the stability of our political system. We're a trusted partner. We're an ethical partner. So Canada sits with massive resources and a Canadian disposition that the world likes. And that's mm-hmm. increasingly important. So we have massive opportunity. And the question is, how do we capitalize on that in a way that really builds value for Canadians? We're good at stripping resources, but we'd like to do more than that. That's been the refrain in pretty much every resource industry mm-hmm. that I've ever engaged in.
And we've also developed a bit of a reputation in recent years. I think it's well-earned, personally, in slowing things down to the point where investors just lose interest and move on to some other place where it's easier to make decisions. So how do we sync these up so we can develop at the speed we want with the protections that the public wants to see and have the outcomes that are needed?
Yeah. This is something that I think about a lot because every conversation I have with young companies, young people, is that Canada is probably one of the hardest jurisdictions in the world to get anything done. Mm-hmm. Now, that's part of our strength, is that once we do stuff, we do it well, right? And we ensure safety and we consider all of the issues. But my challenge to those who are controlling those processes of who gets to do what when is that I actually think that you could go a lot faster and save a lot of money if you change the incentive structure for the people making the decisions. But that's, I don't know if you want to go in that direction.
Well, I think that message is needed in some places. Yeah, for example, Ottawa. Yeah. I know you don't like to travel too much. You've got so much work to do here. But if you can convey this to Ottawa, I think they want to hear. I mean, we've heard very clearly from the Natural Resources Canada Minister, Jonathan Wilkinson, that mm-hmm. he does want to speed up these very slow times. And they're still looking for ways to do that. I think a lot of that is at the social side of mm-hmm. ensuring the processes have the necessary inputs, but also don't get bogged down forever in endless appeals and so on.
Okay, so first of all, I mean, I have a lot of time for Jonathan Wilkinson. I'm going to tell you a story about him. So he was the CEO of a company called Quest Air Industries. Quest Air Industries pioneered some solid-state sorbents for pressure swing absorption gas processing systems, which just so happened to be really useful for things like cleaning up renewable natural gas and doing point source carbon capture. There's a company called Svante, which is, I would argue, the world's leading carbon capture company.
It's a great story.
Developed by University of Victoria graduates, by the way, with the founders from Quest Air Industries, Jonathan Wilkinson's company, which he left to go into politics. And there's another company called Hydron Energy, which is doing small-scale agricultural gas cleanup so that you can introduce biogas into the natural gas grid. So that company that he was part of and the CEO of has actually been the seed of, I think I counted six new startups. excuse me for coughing. Six, at least that I know of, right? Fantastic core that's generated an awful lot of innovation in the province. So I have a lot of time for where he comes from, right? And I don't mean in any way in any of my comments to be wanting to point fingers.
Yeah, I don't think he created personally the situation we have now, but he seems to want to fix it.
I don't think anybody created the situation. And I think that the people who work in the regulatory framework need our respect and our care and compassion because they have a tough road to hoe.
It is tough. Oh, yeah.
Okay. So let's just make sure that as we talk about, you know, from our vantage point, which doesn't know any of the internal details and struggles of the, of living that life, it's pretty easy to pontificate on how it could be better. But I would suggest this. If you could change the reward structure for the individuals to incentivize them to succeed without compromising the requirements for safety, for public engagement, I think we could go a lot faster. And in so doing, we could save a lot of money. So if I was running for prime minister, that's the platform I'd run on. 3-year regulatory cycle implemented 5 years from now.
All right. You've been here for the historic launch of the Jed McLean campaign for Prime Minister of Canada.
That's never going to happen, Stuart.
All right.
Okay?
Fictional
because,
one.
Because, I mean, it's so easy to just point fingers and presume, you know, it's so simple. I can just I can just say something like that to you and then I go on to my next topic and make another audacious statement, right? So please understand the respect that I have for the institutions. And please understand, I mean, I've done international standards. I've been at the United Nations. We were the first people to change the regulations. And it's a fun story to allow hydrogen to be flown on commercial aircraft. That was done by a young lady named Anna Stukas, who worked for me at Angstrom Power. She was off at the UN. We developed international standards. We got UL laboratories actually testing against standards. We convinced Air Canada to fly hydrogen. We got Transport Canada approvals. She did it. She was 24 years old when she did it. She's now the vice president for carbon engineering for all of their business development activity. Carbon Engineering, the world's leading direct air capture company, another British Columbia company that we're very proud of. And I'm really proud of Anna.
Yes, we want them to stay here and succeed at home because there's so many other things to do in the world that they want to do as they scale up. But let's hope we don't lose them.
I'll just come back. I mean, if we have the ambition and the motivation and the support, moving that regulatory cycle and shrinking it down would be a worthy target. That would be as valuable as saying we're going to put somebody in the space station to do something else. Like it's really worth doing and it would make a huge difference.
Jed, thanks for that high-level stuff. We don't have a lot of time left because I try to keep this podcast around 40 minutes or so, so we don't test the limits of people's available time. Although I think people who are listening to this right now, if you've got this far, you're really into this topic. So you could probably go to 120 minutes, but we won't.
We won't.
in these last few minutes, though, the BC Center for Innovation and Climate, let me say that again. The BC Center for Innovation and Clean Energy, that's what you started a year and a half ago. You launched that. I'd like to get into some examples of projects that you're supporting. If you could give me some little vignettes and stories so we can all go away from this with a kind of mental picture of the stuff you're doing that you're enabling, some of those scholars or investors, people who are putting it all together into something.
All right. So first of all, to frame it, what I think we're trying to do with the CICE, the Center for Innovation in Clean Energy, is to create intentional communities. I said earlier on that technology is a human endeavor and the technology happens in community. So it's all about people. It's all about bringing people together who are aligned. Now, our focal practice, the thing that we do, which brings those people together, is we give non-dilutive grants. And we want leverage for our money, so we give non-dilutive grants to early stage companies and typically seed stage companies that are going on the path to raising a Series A financing. So our goal is to get it 10 times. We have $100 million. Our goal is to generate $1 billion worth of investment by 2027 or something like that in British Columbia. Okay, so that's great. So I'll give you some little projects that I'm really excited about. We just announced our second open call. We're moving into directed calls, which I must give a plug for before we're done, so I'll come back to that. We've now funded 23 companies in the first 18 months that we've been in existence. To do that, we have evaluated proposals from 190 companies in the province. You think about that. And we maintain a good relationship with all 190. If you apply to CICE, you get a thank you note, not just a rejection.
Good to know.
You're probably going to get a rejection, but you also will get a thank you note because we just appreciate the effort that goes in to thinking these things up and then acting on them. That's what it's all about. Okay, so fun projects. Let's see if I can pick up one in each of the areas that we're working in. All right, let's start with hydrogen. And I'll have to give you two. I've already mentioned one, which was this low temperature refueling, right? That's really quite fascinating stuff. And I'm sort of scrambling hard in my head.
So in the Arctic where there's...
No, Edmonton.
Edmonton.
Prince George, right? Okay. I mean, it's 6 o'clock in the morning, in the middle of winter, and you need to refuel your truck. You know, you can't wait till you warm up and get the sun on it. You got to go. So that's great. And that's with a company called HTEC in Vancouver. They're also working in the port, doing rubber tire gantry cranes, you know, for lifting containers around. We're helping them with that. There's a company, H2 Portable, that is developing hydrogen-powered generators for film sets and movie sets. And what's interesting about that project is that it's small scale, but they're bringing hydrogen into local neighborhoods, right? Film sets all over the place. And so there's a big permitting play that they're trying to sort out with that that's going to enable lots of other things to happen. So I'll move on from hydrogen. Let's talk about bioenergy. Well, I mentioned Hydron Energy that have this wonderful little valve system that allows them to, and an absorbent bed, that allows them to clean up biogas from farms and things like that and put that biogas into the renewable natural gas grid or just the natural gas grid. So that's very exciting. Curiously, we're just starting a project with Metro Vancouver. Now, they don't fit the modus operandi as an early stage company, right? The group at Metro Vancouver, such an innovative thinking group, that they're saying wastewater to energy is actually, it's a thing, right? It's a great thing. So we're looking there, we're working on improving the efficiency of the bioreactors. They're actually making hydrogen on site, feeding it back into their bioreactors. And this is actually improving the efficiency by something like 15 or 20%. Right. So CIC is helping them with that, but we're also helping them with a commercialization strategy because Metro Vancouver doesn't come to mind as a company that can actually sell anything, right? They're a utility. So we'll spin off a company eventually with them. So that's right. That's pretty cool. There's a company called Atlas Energy in Abbotsford. Massively, they're doing ultra capacitor systems for grid stabilization. Now, let me unpack that.
Yes, please do.
Okay. So if you have renewable energy and you're integrating it into the grid, your renewable energy has to match frequency and it can't have dips. It's got to be kind of like a constant power source going in. So you need help. It's like, kind of like a hybridization of a car, right? You shave the peaks off, you avoid the dips, and you want the cheapest way of doing that so that you're not, you know, escalating costs with your renewables. Well, Atlas Power has taken a unique, something called a capacitor, which is like a really short duration form of energy storage. It's a battery, but one that discharges really quickly. They build systems out of these capacitors, and then they're putting them on the grid to stabilize renewable integration. The capacitors were developed at University of British Columbia, Okanagan. So it's a great story because here we go. We've got fundamental research coming out of UBC Okanagan. which has found its way into manufacturing in Abbotsford. And now they're integrating thousands of these capacitors to make systems. And then those systems are being deployed to allow renewable energy onto the grid, which begins to address the first thing we talked about in this podcast, which was how are we going to get more energy, mm-hmm. right? Okay, well, there you go. And this is a massive opportunity. I could go on. I've got 23 stories, but I think I'll stop because we're running out of time.
I'd like to have you back and get into more of those stories. One thing just I'm curious about, you have a defined technology readiness level band that starts at TRL 4, as I understand, from your website and on from there. Mm. With some of these examples, when did you get in? Were you the one who got it over that early stage to become viable and conceptually likely to succeed, or were you later?
I'm going to say later, and I'm going to pass all 100% of the credit to the innovators and those people who are, I don't know, in some cases mortgaging their houses mm-hmm. and giving up their careers to make this stuff happen.
To get to level 5 or 6, that's what you need.
Yeah, that's what it takes. Yeah. And I've been there. I've done that a couple of times in my own career. I mean, I quit the university so many times I've forgotten, right, to start companies and do other things. They've always taken me back, which has been wonderful. And I'm not affiliated with UVic in any way at this point, but I have a deep affection for that institution. But the technology is a human endeavor. It's the commitment of individuals that drive that will make it happen. So whatever we can do to build a community that encourages individuals, that shows examples of individuals that can be an inspiration to young people or old people, by the way, who are at the end of their career, who've got great ideas, you know, you've got like lots of scope to innovate and to make things happen. It can be done. So what we want to do with CICE is build these communities in particular areas of need, align people who have experience, align big organizations who have vested interest, and create, if you like, a fertile ground for innovation to happen. And then maybe we throw some money in to get things going.
Well, Jed McLean, it's been fascinating. It does feel like the conversation we're having has just begun. So we'll come back to this one day. I have so many other questions. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in to the Eco Innovators podcast.
This has been another episode of the Eco Innovators with host Stuart Neuer. The Eco Innovators is made possible by support from the ResourceWorks Society, bringing Canadian innovation to the world since 2013. You can find other episodes at the usual podcast locations, including Spotify and Google Podcast.